Friday failed to pass a draft resolution that would have delayed the reinstatement of the sanctions. The proposal was brought forward by Russia and China. It sought a technical six-month extension of UN Resolution 2231 to encourage continued cooperation between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi condemned the measure as a sordid mess caused by the US and E3 states' persistent misrepresentation of Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
Iran's position on snapback is clear. It is illegal, void, and has no standing. The E3, having breached the deal, cannot claim significant non-performance. Resolution 2231 restrictions will expire permanently on 18 October 2025. Any attempt to revive or extend them is null and void.
Araghchi asserted that the E3's intent is confrontation rather than constructive dialogue. Referring to the June attacks by Israel and the US on Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities, Araghchi said that military actions failed and that the snapback mechanism will also fail to resolve the decades-long dispute over Iran's nuclear program. The top Iranian diplomat emphasized that Tehran will never bow to Western pressure. He reiterated that the only solution to the dispute is dialogue and diplomacy. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has praised the sacrifices of the martyred resistance leaders in foiling U.S.-Israeli schemes against Muslim nations. The IRGC statement was issued on the first anniversary of the Israeli assassination of senior Hezbollah leaders and commanders. It honored senior leaders Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashem Safieddine for their exemplary prudence and courage in transforming the resistance into a global symbol of dignity and strength. The IRGC cited active and intelligent resistance as the only effective means to counter global arrogance and Zionism. It highlighted the escalating Israeli attacks on Gaza, noting that they revealed the regime's inability to eliminate resistance. The IRGC reaffirmed its commitment to supporting the resistance until occupation is eradicated and Al-Quds is liberated, describing this mission as divine and unstoppable. Iran's top security official says martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's remarks decades ago that Israel will not spare any country have now been clearly proven true.
And those statements by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah made several decades ago, and some countries maybe didn't believe, it has become clear now to everyone. Today become clear to everyone that it doesn't show mercy on anyone. The incident in Qatar proved it clearly.
Larijani is in Lebanon to attend Nasrallah's memorial ceremony. He said recent developments have further revealed the true nature of the Israeli regime to regional nations. Larijani also praised the long-standing relationship between Iran and Lebanon, underlining the solidarity between the two nations. During his visit, Larijani is also expected to hold meetings with top Lebanese officials. More Palestinians are killed in the Gaza Strip as Israel pushes ahead with its genocidal campaign in the besieged territory.
We were just sitting there when the missile suddenly struck, without any warning at all. I was still standing on the stairs. I live in the house just behind theirs. I was about to step inside when, by God's mercy, I was spared.
They said they were heading south, and then we heard they had been bombed. The news came that my sister and her family were all martyred. What had they done? We keep running, hiding from one place to another. What did they do to deserve this? We are displaced.
At least 40 Palestinians have been killed across Gaza since dawn, including desperate people looking for aid. The focus of the attacks remains on the northern Gaza city, with more than 70 bodies transferred to barely functioning hospitals in 24 hours. Carpet bombing of the city's northern, eastern and western areas has forced overcrowding in the south. The regime's tanks are also rolling into the city's populated areas, preventing rescue teams from helping those trapped. Meanwhile, in central Gaza, a 17-year-old boy died of starvation, bringing the number of deaths due to famine and malnutrition across the strip to 440. Since October 2023, over 65,500 Palestinians have been killed, with more than 167,500 others injured. The United Nations has announced the addition of 68 companies to its blacklist of entities benefiting from the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. According to a report, the companies are complicit in violating Palestinian human rights through their business ties to Israeli settlements, which are deemed illegal under international law. The new list includes a wide range of firms, from suppliers of construction material and earth-moving equipment to providers of security, travel and financial services. The list now contains 158 companies, the vast majority Israeli. The others are from the US, Canada, China, Britain, France and Germany. The UN has called on companies to take meaningful action to address the adverse human rights impacts of their operations. The Israeli regime has escalated its settlement expansion in recent years, defying international condemnation and mounting demands to cease those activities. Facing a chorus of global condemnation, Israel is confronting unprecedented isolation as diplomatic, cultural, and economic pressures mount. This was shown by a mass walkout preceding Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the United Nations General Assembly. The incident symbolizes a broader international backlash against the war in Gaza, which is now manifesting in official state recognitions of Palestine and widespread boycotts of Tel Aviv.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has addressed the 80th session of the UN General Assembly. Before he began his speech, many countries walked out of the session in protest over the genocide in Gaza. Speaking to an empty room is another sign of Israel's growing isolation at the international community. This isolation is the price to pay for the regime's murder of innocent Palestinians and rejecting the global call for an end to the bloodshed. Netanyahu has acknowledged Israel's isolation, but he describes it as unavoidable consequence of the Gaza war. Speaking this month at a conference, he called on Israelis to become more self-sufficient. He said Tel Aviv has no choice for the coming years, and it is required to deal with the isolation attempts. Global outrage over the dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza, including famine, has swelled in Europe and elsewhere as demonstrators demand that their political leaders do more to stop the crisis. In Italy this week, thousands of workers and students participated in a nationwide strike over Gaza that closed ports and some public transit hubs. The domestic pressure has played a key role in pushing European leaders to find a way to act. Several Western countries, including Britain, France and Canada, recognize the state of Palestine this week. Momentum is also building in the cultural space as well. Spain, Ireland and Netherlands have all threatened to boycott Eurovision 2026, the world's largest music competition, if Israel participates. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called for Israel to be excluded from all international sports, similar to how Russia was banned from the Olympics following the outbreak of the Ukraine war. In the US, more than 4,000 film workers, including A-list stars, signed a pledge this month to boycott certain Israeli film institutions. Despite fierce objections from countries across the globe, the regime is pushing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza and attacks on regional countries. The regime struck several areas of Yemen on Thursday. Just this month, Israel attacked six countries, including Qatar. For now, it seems that while US backing may shield Israel from immediate diplomatic consequences, it cannot reverse the deepening global alienation. This international isolation appears set to intensify as long as the current policies persist.
A Palestinian-British NHS doctor has been cleared of charges of misconduct, defeating a complaint that her anti-Israeli views made her unfit to practice medicine. The case brought up by the group UK Lawyers for Israel marked the second attempt to have Dr. Rami Aladwan's license revoked by the General Medical Council. Latifa Abu Chakra reports from Manchester.
The UK's Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service has ruled that Dr. Rahma Al-Adwan is fit to practice, rejecting accusations of anti-Semitism stemming from her social media posts and public appearances. The case, which was brought by a pro-Israel advocacy group, marks the second time the doctor has successfully defended her license against such complaints. The tribunal's decision reinforces the legal distinction between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism in the context of professional conduct.
There's no purpose having a free speech if it doesn't entitle you to offend other people. And, you know, that's, you know, we live in a democracy, and that's meant to be the cornerstone of our society. So Rafa's done nothing here today apart from exercising that right to free speech, and we all must do so.
The pro-Israel groups alleged that Dr. Al-Adwan's precise terminology, specifically her use of Jewish supremacy instead of Zionism, was in itself proof of misconduct. They argued that this linguistic choice amounted to harassment of British Jews and made her a risk to Jewish patients. The tribunal's dismissal of the charges represents a significant legal blow to the strategy of equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism to silence criticism of Israel.
It's clear that this is not an isolated case. Campaigners point to a wider pattern of the pro-Israel lobby in the UK going after professionals who speak up for Palestine, from teachers to lawyers and now to doctors.
Dr. Al-Adwan's supporters have thrown their full weight behind her case. Amongst them were three doctors facing similar allegations in pending tribunals.
As doctors, we respect the sanctity of life, and this genocide goes exactly against that. And in addition, it's not only the genocide in Gaza, naturally, that we strongly oppose and want to stop. We also oppose the Zionist lobby working overtime to suppress doctors' free speech.
The high volume of complaints filed with the GMC against doctors for expressing pro-Palestinian or anti-Zionist views has in itself been labelled a form of harassment.
I felt like there was a sense of shame from GMC Council. They were not there because I've harmed anyone, and they were not there because I'm a danger. They were there so that they do not upset the Israel lobby.
In its decision, the tribunal cited Dr. Al-Adwan's right to freedom of expression under the European Convention on Human Rights, which in a democracy rightly held more authority than the Zionist lobby. Latifa Abu Shatra, Manchester.
Venezuela's foreign minister slammed the U.S. military activities in the Caribbean Sea, saying Washington is spreading perverse lies to justify aggression.
Today, the aggression is directed at Venezuela, a peaceful and supportive country. Since Venezuela cannot be accused of possessing weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons, today they invent vulgar and perverse lies that no one believes, neither in the United States nor in the world, to justify a monstrous, extravagant, and immoral military threat worth millions.
Speaking at the 80th session of UN General Assembly, Hill said the recent U.S. strike on a vessel in the South Caribbean was in violation of the UN Charter, Venezuela's sovereignty, and even U.S. law. He said the U.S. seeks to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela and exploit the country's vast oil resources. 11 people were killed in the recent U.S. military strike in the southern Caribbean. The U.S. claims they were smuggling narcotics out of Venezuela, but Caracas says none of them were drug traffickers. U.S. military officials are also reportedly considering options for targeting alleged drug traffickers inside Venezuela, with potential strikes anticipated in the coming weeks. And with that, we bring this news bulletin to an end. It's goodbye from me, Bahman Ray.
که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to RIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that. One of the things that Imam Khomeini said was that those who claim that they are the followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they say that we follow him and obey him, they should be his followers in their speech, in their action, in their writing, and whatever they say, okay? So we have to be 100% followers and companions. Well, not companions, because we haven't lived at the time of him. We can still be his, Shia and his follower. But so we have to do exactly what Imam Ali wants from us. Because, Imam Ali, he was the successor to the Prophet, peace be upon him, his progeny. So he was a waliullah. He was the guardian of Allah. He was a representative of Allah. So whatever he said was exactly what Allah would say. Okay. So if you are just like Amir al-Mu'mineen, if you try to follow the example of Amir al-Mu'mineen and, you become one of his Shia, one of his followers, in your speech, in your actions, and in your writing, then you have obeyed Allah. Okay, basically, you have done what Allah wants from you. So this is important, that we don't just make claims that, oh, I am a Shia, I am a follower of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and then you do all kinds of bad things, you commit all kinds of sins, you backbite, you lie, I don't know, you probably make money in a way that's not halal, and then you claim that you are a Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen is not like that.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
sallallahu
A Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen is exactly, he listens to whatever Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Prophet, and all of the Imams have said. Okay, so don't call yourself a Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen, a follower of Imam Ali alayhi salam, if what you are doing, what you are saying, what you are writing, completely goes against the ideals of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, we have to be really careful what we say, what we do, what we write. This is what Imam Khomeini has told us, that we have to follow Amir al-Mu'mineen in every way possible. Okay, only then can we be called the Shia, the followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by the tireless campaigning barrister, Frank McGuinness. Frank was born in Dublin, was raised in the occupied six counties in the north of Ireland, and was called to the Bar of England and Wales in 2016, practicing in the areas of criminal defence, civil law and public law. He's worked against states, employers and landlords, and has a particular expertise in claims relating to Palestinians and anti-Zionists in the struggle against Israeli colonialism and genocide. Thank you very much for joining me today, Frank.
Great to be here, comrade. Thank you for having me.
Well, you mentioned just now how this terrorism legislation is vague in terms of applying to state actors or non-state actors. So this legislation that we have in Britain and other parts of the world can be and is applied in some cases to state actors. In the case of Hamas, because it's the government of Gaza. You also have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has two government ministers. And you also now have this attempt to proscribe the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, even though they're a state actor. This proscription regime, this way of designating particular organizations as terrorists, needs to be talked about. Now, I've known you and I've known of your work for some years, and that's been a great privilege. But you have now gained fame or... Perhaps infamy in some
depends
circles.
Who you talk to.
Depends on who you talk to. For representing Hamas in their bid to be deprescribed, to be removed from the list of terrorist organizations in Britain. So they've put in an application for deprescription to the Home Secretary. What exactly is this prescription regime? And why, in your view, is it important for Hamas to be deprescribed?
Well, I think, again, history is helpful here because
you can't understand the Terrorism Act 2000 without understanding what you identified correctly was the precursor so-called emergency legislation that was deployed in the north of Ireland. So that was a domestic regime, right? It was designed to deal with the fact that within the territory of the so-called United Kingdom, there was a national liberation struggle. And I would say quite a sophisticated one. Various very sophisticated groups like the Provisional IRA and the Irish National Liberation Army were fighting what they said was a war. Both of those organizations were, as far as they were concerned, armies fighting a decolonial, anti-colonial resistance campaign. And so the British state had this problem, which was within its own domestic jurisdiction, but, you know, in its oldest colony, there was a growing constituency of people who didn't want to be a colony of the British Empire and were willing to fight for their liberation, right? This sort of incomplete project of Irish national liberation. And so the problem is that when you're fighting an army, the Geneva Conventions apply and you treat your enemy combatants like they're soldiers in a war and you can intern them. And that's what Britain did in 1971, right? Operation Demetrius. They lifted thousands of Catholics out of their homes, often on the basis of really shoddy intelligence, and just didn't charge them or try them with any kind of criminal offences. It was wartime measures. And so the British Empire being the British Empire, they came up with some euphemism for what was effectively POW status. So they're like, we have to treat these people like POWs because we're treating them like POWs. We're treating them like combatants in a war, not charging them with any offences. So they came up with this euphemism, special category status, and then that leads to this escalation in the struggle, because having bestowed this status, they realised they were kind of bestowing the status of an army on their enemies. And so they tried to take it away. In 1976, they get rid of prison uniforms. So they say you have to wear prison uniforms. And Republican prisoners refused. That led to the dirty protest, right? Because they weren't allowed to walk down the prison corridors to go to the bathroom without wearing a uniform. So that, hence the blanket men. So they were on the blanket, it was described as.
Yes, and this is the blanket protest, which took place over 5 years by Irish Republican political prisoners held at Loncash Prison.
Exactly. And then that escalates. 1980, first attempt at a hunger strike that's aborted. And then the second famous attempt, 1981, 10 men dead. But not before, crucially, Bobby Sands is elected to Parliament, right? And that's in response to this, again, this Thatcher policy of criminalization, right? So it's like, you're just criminals, which is related, I think, to you're just terrorists, right? This is unacceptable, what you do. This your violence is unacceptable. When our British army goes around colonizing half the world, that's fine and that's lawful. But when you fight against it, you're criminals and you're terrorists. So she was trying to, her government was trying to run this whole argument, this whole policy of saying you're all just thugs and criminals. And Bobby Sands obliterated that. At the age of 27, he completely obliterated her claim that you have no legitimacy, you're just thugs. And he went, well, how come I'm in your parliament? And then, may he rest in peace, he succumbed to his hunger strike. So that's really interesting history. I find British people and even British comrades on the left are insufficiently conversant with that history. But we in Ireland know our history, I think, much better. And we understand that 1981 was this pivotal turning point because it led to what Sinn Féin, right, the political wing of the Provisional IRA, described as the strategy of obtaining power with the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in the other, right? Infamous phrase, Armalite was a kind of machine gun that the IRA was fond of using. And you see something very similar in the Palestinian context, right? There's this idea that we'll win elections, but we're not going to disavow armed struggle. And like so many groups, there is a kind of non-military aspect of Hamas, and there is a military wing, right? And so, thinking about history, Tony Blair comes along and sort of presents himself as this peacemaker in the north of Ireland. And I would say I'm somewhat critical of some people in the north of Ireland who still have this funny little soft spot for Tony Blair because they thank him for the Good Friday Agreement, which is 1998, 1 year into his tenure. And so I think they're overly soft on Blair. And it's frankly a failure of international solidarity because, of course, we don't need to. It's staggeringly obvious that Blair was then responsible for horrific wars in the Middle East. He committed the crime of aggression for which war criminals were executed at Nuremberg. So this is kind of a meandering legal political history I'm offering here. But 1997, Blair's elected. 1998, Human Rights Act, Good Friday Agreement. And then 2000 is the Terrorism Act. So what's happening there? It's like he says, look, I'm gonna help to facilitate a peace treaty, Belfast Agreement or Good Friday Agreement in 1998. But then I'm going to consolidate what we found to be this very useful regime for dealing with terrorists in the north of Ireland, so-called terrorists in the north of Ireland, and I'm going to internationalize it. And then a year after that act is passed, a large number of groups get added to the list. including the military wing of Hamas. So throughout the Troubles, the British government, for all its flaws, observed a policy of saying, do you know what, we're not going to proscribe Sinn Féin. We're going to observe the distinction that the IRA tells us they observe between their military wing and their political wing, and we are going to accept that the politicians, people like Gerry Adams, are not engaged in armed struggle, but the military wing is. So it's illegal to be a member of the IRA, but it's not illegal to be a member of Sinn Féin. And I think the logic, it's clear, was that by making politicians illegal, you send a really disturbing message, right? Bobby Sands, and then thereafter other people, win election to your own parliament. They participate in your own so-called democratic process, but you say, we don't like who the Catholic population of the north of Ireland voted for, so we're going to make it illegal. It's just a terrible look, right? But I think partly through racism, but also partly because people winning election for the political wing of the IRA provokes a constitutional crisis in a so-called United Kingdom in a way that it doesn't in somewhere like Palestine. In 2021, Priti Patel made this astonishing decision to proscribe the political wing. So she departed from what had been this long-standing state policy in Britain of saying, well, whatever else we think of the armed wing, we're not going to proscribe the political wing. We're not going to start telling the people of Palestine that they voted for the wrong people, and so we're going to criminalize their political representatives. Like, that's a unabashed, full-frontal assault on democracy. But it's not surprising. I think it's understated in the public discourse in a country like Britain around this stuff. Obviously, Iran is part of the picture here. We all saw those Iranian missile strikes after, you know, they were forced to defend themselves against an aggressive war that the Zionist entity launched against them. It is staggering to me how British people, British politicians, the British state dares to lecture the Iranians. When you think about that country's history, you think about the way that the British Empire, again, in a staggering affront to democracy, just said, oh, you voted for Mossadegh, wrong guy. We're going to, in a staggering affront to democracy, we're just going to impose the Shah because of the Persian, what was it called, Anglo-Persian Oil Company or whatever. Literally, we are engaged in colonial plunder, and we don't like that you've elected someone who's democratically about to nationalize our oil interests. So we're, you know, to hell with democracy. We're just going to replace him with our preferred candidate. So I don't think anyone who's paying attention expects the British Empire to care about democracy. Like, that would be ridiculous. I'm not trying to be nasty. It's silly. Like, the British Empire doesn't care about democracy.
Well, they're not silly enough, in a way, to believe in democracy, because they know that in order to preserve their interests, they can't rely on those interests being meaningfully changed through democratic means. So in many respects, we have a veil of democracy in many Western countries, not just Britain, but when it comes to fundamental interests and state policies, those can't meaningfully ever be changed through democratic processes.
Absolutely. It's so-called bourgeois democracy. It's not real democracy. And I'm not saying that to be like idealistic or moralistic. I'm just like, what is democracy? It's about, you know, people having power. I would say workers having power. And workers don't have very much power at all in Britain. To the extent that we do, it's through the workplace, not through parliament. I think that there is economic democracy, which is the thing that most affects ordinary people, is power in their workplace, power over the thing that they spend most of their life doing, which is their job, right? Under capitalism, workers are coerced into selling their labor power for a wage so that they can pay for the things they need to live, like rent and food and all the rest of it. That is capitalism in a nutshell. That's the economic struggle. Hey, like, you're exploiting me. And if you paid me more, I would be more able to buy the things that I need. And then the political struggle is how these individual workplace struggles end up becoming aggregated in something like the state, right? So I have some friends who are anarchists, who are syndicalists, and I have a lot of respect and time for them, but I disagree with them because some of them would say, we should just focus on the economic struggle. We should just make a big union that fights bosses, and that's our strategy. And it's all well and good, but the point is, what do you do about the state, the problem of the state? So you want to organize in a workplace, you want to go on strike. You're going to encounter laws like the Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act 1992, which remains the spine, in my opinion, of the British Constitution. It is more than anything else the consolidation of neoliberal class relations and the notion that it should be extremely difficult for workers to go on strike. So I don't have easy answers. I'm just one person. But it seems to me like there's a very interesting, complex relationship between the economic and the political. And that takes us to the question of what is to be done about state power, what is to be done about democracy. And in a bourgeois country like Britain, they tell us, like, oh, you can choose between Labour and the Tories, and maybe if you're an idiot, you can vote for the Lib Dems, and imagine that that's something other than just throwing your vote away. But if, even with Jeremy Corbyn, who is, you know, a social democrat, some kind of liberal social democrat, believes in capitalism and believes in the Labour Party, oh, no, that's too much. And then you see the deep state coming out and attacking him, the media, even generals threatening to coup him in the firing practice and stuff. So it's like the limits of democracy are laid bare. You can vote for everyone, anyone you want, so long as it's a person who believes in capitalism. But if it's someone who even believes in mild social democratic reform, like, you must not be allowed to have that. His own parliamentary party rebels against him. Every part of the deep state rebels against him. And Ralph Miliband has a really good analysis of this, where he says, like, he's thinking about Allende and all the rest of it. Like, what's your strategy? You want to achieve socialism through a bourgeois parliament? Go on then. What's your strategy? Like, you understand that the judiciary, the military, the civil service, the press, like, everything is going to rebel against you because it's the bourgeois state and it's designed to advance bourgeois class interests. So as a socialist, what's your strategy for dealing with that? And he says something about, well, you just have to constantly mobilize. You have to constantly mobilize the working class and increase their participation.
But people are fickle, aren't they? I mean, even Ralph Miliband, and I like early Ralph Miliband, but even, you know, he, after writing Parliamentary Socialism, in which he savagely attacks the idea of achieving change through the Labour Party in Parliament, gets sucked into the idea of Parliamentary Socialism because Tony Benn, a great stalwart of the British left, becomes Minister of Technology, and apparently this is the great advance of the left. And so everyone starts saying, oh, now we have the opportunity to actually administer state power. We never thought we'd get here, now we're here. And the same sort of thing happened with Jeremy Corbyn, right? So people spent lots of time on the left in Britain thinking, we've got to organise outside of the Labour Party, outside of Parliament, to create a meaningful opposition to the status quo. But then when Jeremy Corbyn becomes Labour leader, they start saying, oh, now we have our guy as the Labour Party leader. Maybe everything we thought was wrong. Maybe we can win an election and we can have our guy as the Prime Minister. So everything that you think and know to be true just goes out of the window and you get sort of sucked into the noise. And there is this sort of, not for me actually, but there is this sort of glamour around Parliament and members of Parliament. And you know, aren't they so brave when they stand in the House of Commons and they give this speech? I mean, you obviously are not convinced by this sort of thing. But many people are, and they think that this is the most effective way to achieve power in this country, even if they have rationally thought it through. So it's difficult to sort of mobilize when you have this fickle, even wet thinking among many people who ought to know better.
I totally agree with that, and I think part of the solution is that we need to make organizations that have a clearer, sharper set of politics that we cultivate together collectively, and, you know, a praxis, so-called, right, a theory and a practice. So we need to really engage in rigorous theoretical critique of everything, like really try to understand reality, and then put in place a more revolutionary strategy. I absolutely agree with that, and I think partly that's about finding spaces to embolden each other to engage in a more satisfying approach to politics. And I do think there's a very interesting complex relationship between the economic struggle and the political struggle. And you see that with these big trade unions, and then there's the struggle for democracy within trade unions. It's almost always the case that the members of a trade union and the ordinary workers in a workplace are more militant than what their trade union bureaucracy will allow. And then that creates complicated questions, because in this country, obviously, we have some smaller so-called base unions that are much more members-led. And coming back to Palestine, they've mostly been pretty terrible on Palestine, right? So no easy answers for you, but it does seem as though remaining grounded in the economic struggle and thinking about what some people call economic democracy, right, the idea that more than anything, people should have control over their workplaces. And when you think about voting, this very bourgeois understanding of democracy that every 5 years you get to have a vote for which shade of capitalist is going to dominate you, like, the far more important vote that ordinary people can make in their lives is a vote to go on strike. Like, and you see it. I've been involved in contributing to strike campaigns, and it's incredible to see the transformation in people whenever they realize, like, what, we can vote to withdraw our labor, and if we do, we will gain control of our workplaces. It's stunning.
Although this is entry level stuff, I should also say, and people engaging in trade unions is one thing, but that isn't, I would say, the real struggle. There has to be a broader consciousness building through engagement with theory and also a practical application of that theory when the opportunity arises. I mean, we often hear about the shock doctrine, which is used to implement neoliberalism. Well, I think we need our own shock doctrine. We're not as effective as other political actors in taking advantage of crises to implement our politics. I don't think we've done that as effectively as we should have been in almost 2 years of genocide in Gaza. And on that note, we have to take a break, but we'll see you for part two of Attrition very shortly. Welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi, and I'm delighted to be joined today by the campaigning barrister, Frank McGuinness. Frank, we were just discussing how anti-imperialists often fail to take advantage of political crises to advance the cause, and we've seen that with Gaza, haven't we?
That's absolutely correct, and it's a sign of how weak the left is. And I was talking about this earlier, the international brigades, right, used to be, and there's a very interesting history of the Spanish Civil War, but broadly it's clear that there was a fight against fascism, and the left sent a load of people to join the fight against fascism. And you compare that to Gaza, like, it's absolutely a fight against fascism. Like, whatever else people might have wanted Zionism to become, it's clear that it's become fascist. If it wasn't, some people would say it was always fascist, but certainly it's undeniably fascist now. You have government ministers like Smotrich just openly saying, yes, I'm a fascist. And where is the left? And that's not some, there's a risk of that becoming this moral chastising, chiding, like, oh, why is the left not better? Like, that's voluntarism, right? I'm not here to say we should be better, we should be stronger. It's like, we're not strong, we're weak. And we should admit that. The left in the so-called West, in the global North, and in developed countries is extremely weak. You're right to say that in this country it was smashed. The miners' strike is perhaps the most obvious example of that, right? One of the most militant trade unions in the country was violently attacked by police forces that Thatcher bust in from around the country to physically confront organized labor, and she won. And then her government consolidated that victory in the form of the 1920s.
Well, that example you mentioned there about the Battle of Orgreave, and there were many other examples, not just that one, of the British police violently attacking striking miners during the miners' strike of the 1980s. It relates to a question I wanted to ask, which is that if the concept of terrorism started with this idea that the state has a monopoly on violence, we're now in a position where the state has gained a monopoly on what is legitimate political expression. And so in many ways, you could say, well, they've always had that. You know, the miners' strike obviously is a great example of how when people are engaging in a form of protest, which is what striking is, it's a form of protest in order to achieve a particular demand, they were then obviously violently attacked. But we've now seen non-violent political activity in the case of the Prescription of Palestine Action come under the purview of terrorism. So surely that's a clear example of the whole terrorism apparatus being completely fallacious. I mean, can you speak about broadly what this means? Because obviously this is an escalation. It's the first time since the Terrorism Act 2000 came about that a non-violent direct action group has been prescribed. And of course, there's now a judicial review, which is a type of legal process that's been brought against the British government to try to overturn that ban. I appreciate that you're not directly involved in that judicial review, but could you explain what that's about? Because this is a live issue that people should be continuing to campaign on.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on this. So I think that the British state looks incredibly weak right now. It is, of course, responsible. The British Empire passed the Balfour Declaration, presided over the colonial Palestine mandate, used its control of that mandate to facilitate the emergence of the so-called Jewish state, and is therefore more than any other state responsible for the emergence of the Zionist entity and the ongoing project of ethnically cleansing Palestine, right? And it's worth noting that it was British imperialists who first fantasized about this idea of a Jewish state, right? And I've talked before about Andreas Malm's pamphlet, The Destruction of Palestine is the Destruction of the Earth, very thoughtful analysis. And he talked about 1840, right? 1840, the British Navy was bombing Acre on the Mediterranean coast. And so it's almost 200 years as the Brits fantasizing about having a little loyal Jewish Ulster, right? That's Ronald Thor's infamous phrase, right, when he was the colonial governor of Jerusalem. And so the British state has always been committed to Zionism, and it derives a certain degree of military, diplomatic, and sort of strategic benefit from having this unsinkable aircraft carrier. The baton has very much passed to the Yanks now. Like, it went through the French, so it was an interesting period. The French obviously helped the Zionist entity to develop a nuclear bomb. And then I think around about the 70s, it sort of passes the US being the main broker of the Zionist entity. And so it seems clear that, you know, so-called Israel can't really survive without a proper, you know, sometimes called great power backer, right? They need a really powerful imperialist metropole to support them, without which they wouldn't survive. And you see that from even just this war on Iran, right? They start a war on Iran, an aggressive war on Iran, and then Iran says, you know, we're not, like, we're the biggest regional hegemon, really, and we've got a lot of ballistic missiles. In a war of attrition, we've got 90 million people, and you've got, what, like, less than a tenth of that. And we all saw it. We all saw Israel getting hammered by these missiles slamming into Tel Aviv and Haifa, and it took the US intervening to save Israel. So everyone saw it. It's like, if there were any illusions about it now, Iran was like, in a straight-up conflict between Israel and Iran, Iran wins, absent nuclear weapons, which isn't interesting.
Thank you very much, Frank, for joining me. See you on the next one.
Before over a million times, who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the moment so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever? Won't you be my partner after this world? We'll see when we believe it together. The dreams are meant to be, 'cause you're the one. Lord, I bless you every single day. I'll just say it, 'cause you're the one. And when times are tough, we've got the world to see. Standing right beside you's where I wanna be. I just know it, you are the one. Won't you be? Just over a million times. Who had ever thought that I could call you mine? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. And when there's gray in our hair, we've not much to do. I wanna spend the rest of my days with you. Oh, don't you know it? You are the one. Won't you be the one?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Some features of Muhammad's ideal society explained by Ayatollah Khamenei. Statements made during a Friday sermon, May 18th, 2001. The great prophet of Islam, he was the chosen one above all mankind throughout history, the spiritual father of Muslims and all humans, who believed in progression and exaltation of humanity. On the anniversary that marks the passing away of this noble prophet, one of our duties is to be grateful, both by words and heart, for the exceptional and assiduous efforts as well as endeavors of this accomplished scholar and human being. I will speak on the Prophet's style of governance during his 10 years of Islamic governing in Medina, which is one of the most glorious, and it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say it was the most glorious epoch throughout mankind's history. The system that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, his progeny established had various features. Seven are the most important and outstanding. The first feature is faith coupled with spirituality. The motivation and the true driving force in Prophet's ideal government and system of ruling is a special kind of faith, one that emerges from the hearts and minds of the population, flowing in the right direction through their hands, arms, and eventually their entire bodies. Thus, the first feature is to exert these moving outlooks, then consolidate a will of faith with spirituality, creating the suitable mindset among the people. This is what the Prophet started in Mecca that led to a raised flag symbolizing his power in Medina. The second feature is justice with uprightness. The basis of performance rests upon justice and fairness, be it any case, to defend and give back every individual's rights without compromise. The third feature is science-paired knowledge. In the Prophet's system, the basis for each and every affair is knowledge, recognition, awareness, and awakening. No one is swayed towards one direction blindly. People are turned into active forces rather than passive ones by means of awareness, knowledge, and the recognition of power. The fourth feature is tolerance with brotherhood. In the Prophet's establishment, conflicts and disputes that emerge from superstitious, personal, and self-interest-seeking motives are shunned and fought. The environment becomes an environment of friendship, brotherhood, and empathy. The fifth feature is reformation of behavior and attitude. This concept purifies the human soul and wipes away corruption and moral vices, creating a well-mannered and cleansed human. It purifies you and teaches you the book and wisdom, the Quran chapter 2, verse 151. Self-purification is one of its main pillars. In other words, the Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, would take his time on every individual to bring out the best in them in terms of behavior and human qualities. The sixth feature is dignity with power. The society and system established by the Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, would not be one that is easily intimidated and dependent or blindly follows one who stretches out his hand to anyone and pleads for help. A Muslim is dignified and decisive. Once he recognizes what is best for him, he works to achieve and makes progress towards it. The seventh feature is perpetual work, movement, and progression. There is no halt in the Prophet system. It habitually moves, operates, and progresses. It never happens that the governing system stops for a break. It does not happen. Of course, this occupation is gratifying and enjoyable. It is not a boring and tiring job. It's a task that would reward one with delight, motivation, and enthusiasm.
Oh, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. From Tehran, a warm greetings to each and every one of you, dear listeners. Welcome to Iran Radio, your daily source of inspiration and reflection. Broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Together, we'll explore moments of faith, seek knowledge, and share stories that bridge hearts across the distances. So whenever you are at home, on the road, or taking a quiet moment, stay with us. A rich tapestry of voices, insights, and culture awaits you. First up, we have today's special. This daily program is a vibrant fusion of faith and culture, exploring various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Get ready for a rich tapestry of Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, inspiring nasheeds, insightful reports, and so much more. Then get ready to listen to the hadith of the day. Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish shares a profound hadith from the Holy Prophet and his revered family, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. You'll